It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Chinese doctor who sounded the alarm on the Wuhan coronavirus died of the virus in the early hours of Friday morning, according to a statement from Wuhan Central Hospital. Li Wenlian was accused of rumor mongering by Wuhan police after raising concerns about the virus in December.
He was among several whistleblowers that emerged in that moment. Even the Supreme Court of China said that had local authorities listened early on, and Wuhan police in particular, things might have been different when it comes to the current outbreak that China is experiencing and really the global community is experiencing right now. The second narrative that's coming out of here now is this concern with state media and how they first reported this. It was late Thursday night, just a few hours ago. They suggested that he, in fact, did die. And then the outrage and the emotion and the anger on social media here was quick, and it was sudden. I mean, it came through, and it erupted. It was trending, and folks were really starting to express themselves like you had not seen here in years, to be quite honest. Then what happened was state media pulled it down, and they did that in citing Wuhan Central Hospital. And Wuhan Central Hospital said, he's not dead, he's in critical condition, and we're trying to resuscitate him. And they maintained that statement for several hours. Meantime, the tweets that came from Global Times, the tweets that came from People's Daily, which is the ruling Communist Party's official newspaper, those were deleted. And folks online continued to express their concern. And what we're now seeing is they're posting back again. But one top comment that's getting a lot of likes right now is somebody saying, you can repost this in the middle of the night thinking we're not watching, but we are up and we are watching, saying.
All right, that was a story from CNN about, 6 weeks ago. It seems like 100 years. And that's when I think Americans really understood for the first time how dangerous the coronavirus is and actually how suppressed and dangerous things were for the Chinese people. And so with that, I'd like to talk today about what's happened in China since the outbreak started last October. Where did this virus come from? What has been the effect on the Chinese economy? What is going to be the effect on our economy? What is the role of the communist leadership in all of this? And what dangers are there that we have not even discussed yet? And to join me today to talk about that is someone who knows all about it. Gordon Chang is a Gatestone Institute Distinguished Fellow. He's also the author of The Coming Collapse of China. And by the way, you can find all of his information at his at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, thanks for joining me this morning.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Sandy.
Now, you wrote, at the time that this happened, you wrote a long article about the death of Dr. Li Wenling in Wuhan. And so tell us more about him. I know some people knew about this, but others are really not all that familiar with the story. What happened with him?
Well, he was one of the Wuhan 8, or 8 doctors who were warning the city of the coronavirus outbreak. And he was brought in to the police along with the others. They harassed him. They forced him to retract. And as everyone knows, China would have had a much more effective response at the end of December if they had listened to Dr. Li and the others. He died February 7th. That triggered that massive outpouring of emotion on Chinese social media, as we just heard in your introduction. And that has also led to something else that we haven't seen in a long time, and that was demands for fundamental political change in China across the country. People were starting to say, look, we need freedom of speech, and at that time, many Chinese people were adopting the anthem of Do You Hear the People Sing, which is that politically impactful song from Les Miserables.
Yes.
The reason why it's so important in China was that the people in Hong Kong had adopted that as their song as well. And so it had political ramifications that the people in Beijing understood. And that's why this death, one death, has changed China.
I think you're right, Gordon. And you did point out also in your article, because you... Look, I know a lot about communism. You know this. You know that I've been to China several times and Russia. I lived in Berlin, Germany. I've been to Vietnam, every communist country. I know a lot about it. I grew up during the time of the Cold War. But you know more. You are, part of you is Chinese, half of you. The other part is Scottish. And your wife is very invested, loving the Chinese people. I think she's from Hong Kong originally. So you have a lot of knowledge about how communism has affected China directly. And you make the point that the Communist Party there, especially now, some Communist parties hold a stronger grip on their people than others. And the current regime is holding a strong grip. And you said because something kind of snapped in the people when this doctor died of the virus, and they just lost their fear. They've lost their fear of the regime. Say something about that.
Yeah. Regimes fall when people do lose their fear, when they don't care anymore or when they become desperate. And that's, if you go back into Chinese history, the first imperial reign fell when two laborers just decided that they had nothing to lose. And so they then, you know, start fighting. And that led to the fall of the Qing Dynasty. The important thing here going forward is that the Chinese Communist Party has, as you mentioned, exercised extraordinary control over the people. It's moving away from authoritarianism back to totalitarianism, especially with their social credit system, with all their surveillance cameras, and the rest of it. But people just are not going to be cowed right now. Now, China is still struggling with the disease, and I think that when it subsides, you're going to see a new attitude on the part of the Chinese. Then the recriminations will begin in earnest, and I think that the party will then have a very difficult time. That's not to say that the party will fall at this particular moment, but it is to say that it is going to be stressed in a way that it hasn't been stressed before, especially because the Chinese economy right now is contracting, and that is by itself an existential crisis for the regime.
Yes, and I want to talk about the economy. I do. I want to get to that. But I want to ask you first, you know, initially we were told that this thing broke out in Wuhan, and then we were told that there was allegedly a chemical weapons plant that was in that same vicinity, very close. I don't know. What do you know about? What do we know for sure about the origins of this virus?
Well, we know it was somewhere around Wuhan, but exactly where, we don't know. The dominant narrative is that it broke out at a wet market in Wuhan, presumably from a bat that was being sold as food. But also people say that it could be a Wuhan bio lab, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is 20 miles south of that wet market. And there at that lab, they do experiments on coronavirus. There's a lot of science both ways, Sandy, but we don't know exactly yet. But the one thing we do know is that the Chinese government, the Communist Party, have been doing their best to prevent foreign virologists from studying the origin of the outbreak. So we've got to be concerned. Right now, you know, there's a lot of people are saying that President Trump's labeling of the disease as the Chinese virus is wrong. Well, it's not wrong for a lot of reasons, but it certainly wouldn't be wrong if this were an engineered bug. And there are indications that indeed it is, that it was engineered by China. So until we have a full investigation of the origins, it's possible that this did escape from the lab, and we've got to keep that option on the table.
You know, I was listening to some news reports just preparing to talk to you today, and there was a report back in October of this year, before I don't think we had even heard about the outbreak in October here, but it was an NBC News report, and it was a report, I do remember this report, it was a report on drug shortages, heparin primarily and other things, and they were just noticing that, I think they said about 100 drugs were becoming really hard to get, Now, because of this coronavirus, we are learning the extreme control that China has over our drugs. I mean, we come up with the technology, we innovate the drugs, but they're all, 80%, I think, of our antibiotics and other drugs are manufactured in China. My question is, I know you don't know the answer to this, Gordon, but why would there suddenly be a shortage of these drugs that are manufactured in China back in October of 2019? What's the possible explanation?
Yeah, I don't know the explanation for that, but you know, we do know several things that you pointed out. And one of them is that we have an extraordinarily dependence on China for our pharmaceuticals, and on antibiotics, which you mentioned, we either buy 80% or 97% of our antibiotics, depending on who's counting, from China. And we shouldn't rely on any country to that extent, but certainly not a hostile regime like China. You know, right now, during the coronavirus outbreak, drugs are becoming in short supply. Our FDA has pointed out that one such drug that is manufactured in China is indeed limited, and they won't mention which one it is. But the point is that China is being right now severely tested, and we're not getting products out of China, pharmaceuticals and others. And this could, in the case of pharmaceuticals, have a severe impact on many Americans who depend on Chinese drugs. You mentioned heparin. We've had adulterated heparin coming from China. The FDA has generally inspectors in China, but that is an inadequate system to begin with. And now those inspectors aren't there because they've been withdrawn by the U.S. government due to the coronavirus epidemic. So we have all sorts of questions about our reliance on China for some critical items. And it's not just pharmaceuticals.
Oh, no, absolutely not. You know, isn't it ironic? We can make this a political discussion, but it has to be said that President Trump, from the incubation of his running for president, and even way back as a businessman, has long repeated over and over again the dangerous relationship and dependence we've gotten into with China and his intent to change that. You would think that this situation would underscore how right he was, but not quite. Instead, he's being blamed for the virus. You know, I find it ironic, you know, Gordon, that China has now, according to what I'm reading, been sort of threatening us with withholding medications. They've actually put it in print by a state-run media agency. What do you know about that?
Well, yes. Beijing 4 or 5 days ago actually did threaten to withhold medications and also medical protective gear that are made in China because they're upset about certain things, including our actions against Huawei Technologies, which has been which is a threat to the United States, which has been surveilling countries around the world. Clearly, Beijing has been trying to use its position in the manufacturing base of the world to obtain geopolitical ends, and that really puts us at risk. Peter Navarro, President Trump's trade advisor, said that he would, in a few days, be putting together an executive order for President Trump's signature on reducing our reliance on China for pharmaceuticals. And even, you know, we go back to the early days of the Trump administration. On July 21st, 2017, the president issued his executive order on the supply chain because he was worried about vulnerability to foreign countries. And so this is something that is a theme, as you point out, from the first days of the Trump administration. They've been thinking about what do we do to make sure that America makes the things that it needs and doesn't have to rely on countries like China for them.
It would be so ironic if this shutdown of our country, really of the world, but I'll talk about our country, could cause Americans to finally come to grips with why cheap and inexpensive goods are too high a price to pay for the kind of dependence we have on a government that is not our friend. They are not our friend. All right, we have to take a break. Our guest is Gordon Chang. By the way, we're going to put on our Facebook page several articles Gordon has written, and we're going to put the one about the death of Dr. Li Wenliang, which is fascinating, and others. So I hope you'll go there and read it. Also, you can go to @GordonGChang. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Mass General has a tough enough job without having to deal with a drug shortage.
I never thought we would get to a point in the U.S. healthcare system where we wouldn't have essential medicines to be able to treat patients.
The hospital can't get enough of the blood thinner heparin, crucial for cardiac surgery.
How surprising was it for you to hear that there was a heparin shortage?
Oh, it was completely surprising. It's extremely frustrating. I mean, it's like McDonald's running out of ketchup.
But heparin is far from the only drug in short supply. Right now, Mass General is facing more than 100 shortages. According to a new FDA report, nationwide shortages are getting worse. 116 as of this week, including a cancer medication for children.
She is our miracle, and it's gut-wrenching.
Our generic drug supply is broken.
On Wednesday, a hearing on Capitol Hill looked at one of the reasons. Two-thirds of key drug ingredients are manufactured overseas.
Right now, hospitals are rationing critical drugs.
This is our alternative.
Mass General relies on alternative medications and conserving where it can, not knowing how long a shortage will last. With heparin supplies low, a crisis team meets daily.
It is simply not possible for us to do heart surgery without heparin. Impossible. Wouldn't happen.
This is the fourth time in the last 2 years we've had to activate our hospital's emergency operations plan for a major drug shortage.
You've come close to not being able to do cardiac surgeries?
That's correct.
The fix won't be easy or cheap, but finding a solution is critical. Stephanie Gosk, NBC News, Boston.
All right, now that's the report I was talking about. That was last October, a report out of Boston. And they were talking about the shortage of drugs, and all of those drugs they mentioned are manufactured in China. You just heard the breakdown. Chinese pharmaceutical companies, they supply between 80% and 90% of U.S. antibiotics, 70% of acetaminophen, and 40% of heparin. Gordon Chang is my guest, and of course, we're talking about all things China. And Gordon, before the break, I said something about, wouldn't it be amazing if what America's going through right now, the trauma for Americans, even if it's, I have to qualify that and say, we have not seen real trauma until we've seen real body bags marching out of our neighbors' houses. But just the specter of something like that has really shut the country down. Wouldn't it be something if that would shake people up so much that we actually would separate from China, separate our economies, and start protecting ourselves? Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, Sandy, and it's something that we need to do for a number of reasons. But we have become critically reliant on China in a number of sectors, and we shouldn't be doing that, especially because China has declared a people's war on the U.S. It did that last May. So being reliant on a hostile regime just does not make any sense whatsoever. We're starting to see people understand the downsides of our relationship with China. Yes, they can manufacture things cheaper than we can, but it doesn't really matter if you can't get access to those things for one reason or another. Now, during the coronavirus outbreak, we haven't been able to get to these things because plants in China have shut down. And also, even if some plants were manufacturing things, and some were, you couldn't get them from the factory to the ship. So there's been disruptions in supply chains because of this epidemic. And just in general, we have seen what happens when we have close contact with China, which does create, the world's diseases. And so, therefore, what we need to do as a matter of highest priority is to reduce our dependence on the Chinese regime.
You know, what I always say, and I've been saying this for a long time, is that we must wean ourselves away from cheap goods. You know, my son was in Canada for a number of years, and trust me, you probably know this, Gordon, everything in Canada is very expensive. They are very protectionist. They protect their jobs, they protect their people. It's hard to get jobs there if you're not a citizen. I grumble because, even going out to eat costs so much money. But the upside of that is that Canadians are employed and they're well paid. They pay more for goods and services. They don't buy as much. But people actually have sustaining lives economically. And that's the price. If you call it a price, that's what we have to be prepared to do. We just can't buy as much junk if we wean away from China. Maybe I'm simplifying it too much, but I just think we've just been used to buying so many cheap things. We are addicted to that, and we have to stop thinking differently about it. I'm really curious about one thing. I know you're not a medical person, and perhaps there's no answer you can give to this, but it did strike me that the doctor in China who died in February was only 35 years old. And there have been thousands of deaths in China, and it sounds like I had the impression that there were younger people dying there. And yet we're told that it's older folk dying here and also in Italy and other countries. Do you have any thoughts about that? Does that lend maybe a suggestion it might be a different strain or something?
Well, first of all, a number of people in China have said, well, look, it wasn't the coronavirus that killed Dr. Li, it was the Chinese regime. Now, I actually believe it was the coronavirus, but there's a couple of things going on. One of them is that Dr. Li died in Wuhan. In Wuhan, people died not because they had the disease, but because they couldn't get treatment because the healthcare system was overwhelmed. There was a peak of cases, and the hospitals just couldn't cope. And that's why we saw the scenes of those hospital corridors filled with corpses and just lined with people, because they just couldn't do anything. So that's why I think that a lot of people who ordinarily would have lived in other places died there. And we're starting to see some evidence of what happens when that occurs, when a health system is overwhelmed, because it's also occurring right now in Italy.
Yes.
And what people are trying to do in the U.S. right now is to sort of, as they say, flatten out the curve so that the healthcare system here can cope, that it can take care of people who have been afflicted with the disease and not be overwhelmed like it has been in other places.
Let's talk about, you just wrote another article, actually just came out today, and it came out March 17th. And I found this fascinating, Gordon. The title is China's Real Disease is Not Coronavirus. And so you track what you perceive as the real problem in China, which is, from your perspective, what?
The real disease is communism. And we're starting to see so much in the way of evidence that this is a crisis that did not have to occur. So, for instance, if the regime had listened to Dr. Li and to others, there would not have been such a widespread outbreak of coronavirus in China, and it would not have afflicted the world in the same way that it has, because it's crippled, for instance, Iran, Italy, South Korea, and it's spreading to other places, including, of course, the United States. So really what we have is a disease which was spread by the secrecy of the regime. Remember, Sandy, that the first case of coronavirus, according to the World Health Organization, was diagnosed on December 8th. But Chinese authorities knew about the disease in November. But there was no real public acknowledgement of it until January 20th, when Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, actually spoke to the Chinese people and started to impose draconian measures. So you had at least 6 weeks, and maybe even longer, where this disease spread around China, and people didn't know about it, or they didn't know what was going on. And so, therefore, there was no adequate measures being taken. And just one other fact, and that is on January 19th, one day before Xi Jinping addressed the Chinese people, the authorities in Wuhan held a potluck dinner for 40,000 families because they wanted to get into the Guinness World Book of Records.
Oh,
and really what that did was spread the disease even further. So this is a disease of communism. It is a disease which is made so much worse by China's political system.
Now, an issue, here's where the two cross, because Xi Jinping met with the president. They made this last agreement, which I don't even think you and I talked about that, since that was forged in January. And it was this, we were told it was just the beginning, but it was a good agreement from our perspective, just not the whole thing yet. But you point out in your article that the Xi Jinping and the Chinese are already, we think, not holding up their end of the bargain. You talk about the fact that the story has been told now that they have forced at least one ship, which was carrying masks and gloves and other protective gear for this coronavirus, to return to China. And you say that Xi Jinping knew about this outbreak when he met with the president. Address that a little bit.
Yeah. The phase one trade deal was signed in the East Room of the White House on January 15th. Xi Jinping knew about the severity of the outbreak, at least on January 7th, because we have learned from a speech that he gave on February 3, I believe. From that speech, Xi Jinping said that there was this Politburo Standing Committee meeting on the 7th. That's, the Politburo Standing Committee is the highest organ in China. And in that meeting, Xi Jinping gave orders about what to do to contain the outbreak of the disease. So that's January 7th. The agreement was signed on the 15th. You have all sorts of officials from Beijing, potential disease carriers, walking into the White House, meeting much of the American leadership.
Wow.
And a couple things. One other thing that you were alluding to, and that is, look, the Chinese want out of the Phase 1 deal. They want relief from their core agreement. Well, it sounds reasonable that because the Chinese economy is contracting, all the rest of it. But the point is, the Chinese knew about this epidemic on the 15th when they signed it. This is not something that occurred afterwards. So China probably signed the deal on the 15th, knowing that it was going to ask for relief and therefore knowing it wanted to renege on it.
You know, you give us as evidence of that, which as though you and I, as though most people would need evidence that a communist country and communist leaders lie. I mean, that's kind of like what they do. They have no compunction about that. You give an example of Xi breaking his promise to President Barack Obama over militarizing those artificial islands in, around China. And they broke the agreement. I mean, they just did. I think they did. They were trying to do it in secret. And then it came to light from satellite pictures. So there is a precedent. That's my point. And that's yours, too, in the article.
Yes. On September 2015, Xi Jinping visited the White House. He stood in the Rose Garden with President Obama. And there were two pledges that the Chinese made to the United States. One of them was not to militarize the artificial islands in the Spratlys, which is the archipelago in the southern portion of the South China Sea. China made them into artificial islands. And we were concerned at that time that they were actually going to put planes on them and missiles and the rest of it. Xi Jinping said he wasn't going to do it. Well, since that time, he has. The other agreement that Xi Jinping made with the U.S., he made a pledge to, and President Obama made a pledge to him, reciprocal pledges, that neither country would hack the other country to gain a commercial advantage. And Xi Jinping has never stopped doing that. So they've violated that pledge as well. So we can see what the word of the Communist Party leader Xi Jinping is worth.
We know that they've been building up their military. You know, Bill Gertz has been writing and speaking about this for years. He's not the only one. I'm sure you have been too. But just watching the Chinese military build up, and even when the Chinese leader seemed all warm and fuzzy to us before Xi ever took power, and you know, many of us have been to China. We've had great experiences. But they, behind the scenes, the Chinese military was building up and writing things about undermining us and you know, being aggressive. I remember reading about that, Gordon, and thinking, I can't imagine why the Chinese would want to like take over the world. That doesn't seem to be in their DNA. They seem very content to be, you know, on their own corner of the earth. But I was wrong about that. So now we see that they are making open threats. But I'm curious to know what this virus and the things around it and the contraction of their economy is doing, first of all, to their economy and then also to their ability to actually carry out these threats.
Yeah, the Chinese economy in January and February contracted. January and February are normally aggregated for purposes of reporting Chinese statistics because those are the months of Lunar New Year holiday, and it switches between January and February. So the months are aggregated to minimize the distortion. The January and February figures show a Chinese economy not just contracting, but deeply, deeply in the red. It's almost come to a standstill. We don't know about March, which is the third month of the first calendar quarter. But, China will show some pickup, but it probably will not be enough to prevent the whole quarter from being negative. Now, China probably will report overall growth for the quarter, but that's not credible because January and February account for 60% normally of the output of the first quarter. So you have a China right now that is sort of struggling to get back on its feet. This is, of course, going to affect the rest of the world. And we can see in our own country, Sandy, what happens when we react to a disease. We've had so many events being canceled. We have workers not being able to get to their job sites, all the rest of it. So this is going to be a stand. This is going to be something we're going to see in countries around the world, that the first part of 2020, and maybe even later than that, we're going to have a global downturn because of the disease that escaped from China.
But when you think of future, and if you think about the likely possibility that American manufacturing, God willing, will leave China, that seems to be a long-term, really serious problem for them, whereas I see perhaps in this country a potential upturn as manufacturers and producers, like at the drugs and various things, start to bring work home. I want your comments on that when we return, if you would. Gordon Chang is my guest. He is again with Gatestone Institute, a distinguished fellow, and he's the author of The Coming Collapse of China. You can find Gordon's writings because he's prolific and he knows really so much about the country. We're just barely scratching the surface, but you can follow him on @GordonG Chang on Twitter. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Controlling the narrative or changing it completely. As President Xi Jinping visited Wuhan this week for the first time since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, his government went on the defensive, aggressively responding to another message coming from Washington.
This is the Wuhan coronavirus.
It started in China and is now spreading throughout the world.
As cases rise in the United States, its officials are emphasizing that the pandemic was, quote, made in China.
This virus did not originate in the United States. It originated in Wuhan in Hubei province in China. It originated some time ago. Unfortunately, rather than using best practices, outbreak in Wuhan was covered up.
Such comments by senior U.S. officials have infuriated the Chinese government. Its foreign ministry had this to say.
We urge that U.S. official to respect objective facts and international public opinion and spend time on preventing and controlling the epidemic and strengthening relevant cooperation rather than attacking, slandering, or complaining about others.
U.S. officials have been pushing back against conspiracy theories floating around the internet and Chinese media. Beijing has also pushed the narrative that the virus was brought to China by the U.S. military. Nearly 250 members of the U.S. military were in Wuhan in October last year, along with athletes from 100 other nations, to take part in the World Military Games. The theory has now been widely circulated by state-aligned media. China's new position on the origins of the coronavirus outbreak appears to contradict its own assessment from January.
From what we can see now, the origin is the wild animals sold in the seafood market.
With the number of new cases on the decline in Hubei province, Beijing appears to have taken control of the outbreak. But it also wants to make sure the world doesn't blame China for one of the worst health crises in a decade. Andrew Chappelle, Al Jazeera.
All right. So the Chinese, of course, are turning around and blaming us, saying it was the Americans that brought the virus to China. And that's actually very dangerous. You can call that just a game of accusations, but this is supposed to be our friend and partner in trade, right? Gordon Chang is with me. At Gordon G. Chang is his Twitter handle. Gordon, how serious is it that the Chinese are trying to blame America for this virus?
This is potentially serious, extremely serious. What China is trying to do is to justify in the minds of the senior leadership that they have the right to use force against the U.S., and at the same time, they're trying to prepare the Chinese people for the use of force. China, since the beginning of February, maybe even earlier, has been laying the groundwork for blaming the U.S., and we see this in a number of foreign ministry statements and tweets, as well as the Global Times, which is the Communist Party newspaper. And what President Trump, Vice President Pence, and Secretary of State Pompeo have been doing by talking about Chinese virus or the Wuhan flu is to say, look, this did not start in America. Last Thursday, a foreign ministry spokesman said what we heard in that Al Jazeera report, that patient zero was an American and that the flu was brought to Wuhan by the U.S. Army, intimating germ warfare. And they didn't mention the military games in October. They intimated that this was a biological attack. So I'm not saying that the Chinese are going to lash out at the U.S. or start a war or whatever, but I am saying they are creating the conditions for doing that. And so, therefore, this is potentially consequential. And we've got to be concerned. And I'm very glad that our president, vice president, and secretary of state are pushing back, because we need to do that. People need to understand China started this, and the United States has got to finish it.
Yes, and it makes me even more concerning than their hostility to us is the undermining of our national sovereignty and just what should be natural love and protection of your own country by the media, by, you know, criticizing the president and others for calling this the Wuhan virus, calling it the Trump virus, excusing China. And then we have people in who want to be in power, like Joe Biden, who's running for president, who is an unapologetic advocate, an excuser of China in all things, and who has, according to verifiable reports, his family has been terribly enriched by their relationship with China. And then we have Dianne Feinstein, whose chauffeur for 20 years was a Chinese communist spy. That kind of stuff concerns me more than the Chinese hostility toward us. Just your comments on that, Gordon.
Yes, I mean, we've got to understand that China's penetrated the United States at all levels and is working very hard to do that. And as you say, you can expect Beijing to try to do that, but what is really disheartening is that Americans are taking up China's narratives and they're supporting Beijing against their own government. And this is something that's got to stop. I mean, we Americans have got to unite because we have a common enemy. And if we don't unite, that common enemy could very well defeat us. So it's important that we Americans stay united on this. And, President Trump has been very clear from the very beginning that we've got to defend American sovereignty. He talked about it in his inaugural speech. This is a constant theme of his administration. We all need to get behind it. That's not to say that we have to agree with him on everything, but we do, on the essentials, have to stand behind him because he's the only president we have, and we do have a hostile foreign power out there that wants to take away our sovereignty.
Gordon, of course, when we talk about things like this, we're talking about the Chinese government and their military. We're not really talking about the Chinese people. That's a separate entity. You and I think the last time we really spoke at length was about what was happening in Hong Kong. Of course, that's not mainland, but it's still part of China now. Crying out for freedom. You've already alluded in this discussion today about the renewed calls for free speech. So what's happening to the Chinese people? First, their health after this virus. Do you know anything about, what's happening there in terms of as I understand it, the virus is now on the downswing in China. And secondly, just the Chinese people. What do you know about what's happening inside the country?
Well, right now, people are struggling to get free of the virus. It is subsiding from what we can tell. We're not exactly sure. And we got to remember that in certain parts of China, there could very well be new outbreaks for a number of reasons. So this is a country that is struggling to get back on its feet. You know, on your main point, Sandy, America has natural allies. And those natural allies are the most immediate victims of the Chinese Communist Party. So, of course, the Chinese people, the Taiwanese, people in Hong Kong, Tibetans, the Uyghurs, and the Kazakhs in the northwest, China calls Xinjiang and what the people there call East Turkestan, these are the natural allies of the United States, and we need to build bridges with them because they're the ones who can help us through a very difficult period. We need all the friends we can get, and a lot of those friends happen to be in the neighborhood.
Yeah, we're sort of making new friendships, forging new relationships. And now if we could just shake loose the grip of the power brokers here. And, it's not a party thing. It stretches across party lines. I have to say that, and I have said this on the air, that it was 2004, I believe, when the last antibiotic or pill was manufactured here in the United States. It all went to China, almost all of it. And that was under the Bush presidency, because the Bush family were pushing globalism, and they were certainly pushing China. And yes. Manufacturers and big business were all sending their work over there. And so it started with them.
Yeah, well, it actually started before that. But the point is that, you know, you're absolutely right on this, that this is not a partisan issue. This is, we have seen both parties adopt positions which are extremely favorable to the Communist Party. And what we need is a new consensus. And that new consensus is forming. It started to form in the late part of the Obama era, but it really didn't pick up until President Trump showed some leadership on this. So, you know, we've got to be concerned. This is sort of the real issue is you have elites in the U.S. who feel much more in common with their elites in China than they do with their fellow Americans. And this is something that we have got to change, because this is so dangerous for our safety and security of the American Republic.
A couple of just miscellaneous questions, because I'm curious. I ask you about China's economy, but from your perspective, if we separate from China, and I already alluded to higher prices on goods and services, I guess that's an obvious, but what do you think that will do to our economy, short-term and long-term, if we uncouple from them?
Well, short-term, there's going to be disruption, of course, but long-term, this is good for us, because, you know, we have this image that China is an engine of global growth, and so if we decouple from it, it'll harm us. But actually, that's not true. The engine of global growth is the United States, because to be an engine, you've got to buy the goods and services of other countries. And China, through predatory policies, through theft of intellectual property, is stealing growth from other countries. So if we decouple from China, what we're doing is we're giving them fewer opportunities to steal from us, which means that we're going to be able to commercialize our own innovation. And long term, we're going to be so much more, we're going to be so much stronger if we don't have an economy that is so dependent on China, that is so tied to China. We'll be much better off, Sandy.
Gordon, do you have any sense of whether, now I'm going to speak about Republican leadership, mostly in the Senate, who really are so invested, even some of them personally invested, in relationship with China. Do you see a crack, an opening? Do you see things shifting in the political sphere on this also?
Yes, I do. And I think that it crosses party lines again, because if you look at the Senate, for instance, one of the staunchest supporters of robust China policy is a guy named Chuck Schumer, who is a senator from New York and minority leader. But you also see, of course, Republicans who are staunchly in favor of tougher policies on China. So this is a good thing. And, you know, being a defender of Beijing these days in the U.S. Senate or the House of Representatives is not quite as popular as it used to be. And that's a good thing. But, you know, we Americans, we've just got to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, because the forces on the other side, of course, are strong. But we've got common sense, we've got right, and we've got justice on our side. So we can prevail if we actually are active and robust in defending the American Republic.
Yeah, I just can't help, again, think about the irony of Donald Trump being the character, the figure, the central figure in really this huge shift, this sea change. He is. He didn't create the virus, and that's going to be, you know, a turning point, I think, along the way. But, boy, he's the one that started the narrative against all odds. It's pretty amazing. I want quickly, and I know this is too complicated to do it very quickly, but Huawei, that is the control over the 5G network, which would be enable China to have access to almost everything all over the world. What's the status with that?
Well, the Trump administration put Huawei on the Commerce Department's entity list, which means that no American can contract with Huawei without getting approval in the high-tech area. And the administration is now moving to no federal money for Huawei. And we're also starting to see rip and replace, getting Huawei out of the American telecom backbone. There's a lot that needs to be more that needs to be done, but the administration is moving on it. And I would think that the administration would push much harder if that got a second term. The other thing, of course, is that the administration has asked for the extradition of Meng Wanzhou, who is the Huawei chief financial officer. We've asked that from Canada, and we are want to prosecute her for violating Iran sanctions. So this is a really important issue we have with Ottawa right now. And it's really great that the Trump Justice Department has been pushing this really hard.
Yeah, encouraging times, just encouraging, even in the middle of such a crisis. Well, I hesitate to call it a crisis, to be honest with you, Gordon, because I have mixed feelings about what I feel like a real plague would look different than this. But it is the after effects, the secondary shocks of everything that's happening is really having detrimental effect. Last question. I remember this has been for years. I've been concerned about our debt to the Chinese, the borrowing ratio, that we kept borrowing money. Can you just say 30 seconds on what is China still hold a lot of our debt and what is happening to that in the midst of this?
Well, China's been selling American debt because they need to raise money. So I don't think we should be indebted to them, but this is one problem that might actually take care of itself as China needs more and more cash for various purposes. But no, we should never have become indebted to China.
Lessons to be learned, no question about it. Gordon Chang, my guest, a Gatestone Institute Distinguished Fellow, author of that book, The Coming Collapse of China. And you can follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang. Also, look on Facebook because we're going to put the last several articles that he's written, and they are just excellent. Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for just updating us on what is absolutely a wonderful people. I love the Chinese people. We just pray that they can be free and they can shake free of this government that's oppressing them. Sandy Rios in the morning, AFR Talk.